The title of the split sermon today is A World Devoid of Shalom. A World Devoid of Shalom. It's taking over our lives. It's invaded our homes. It dictates when and how we eat. It robs us of time with loved ones. It separates husbands from wives and parents from children geographically, and increasingly reverses the traditional roles of husbands and wives. It takes mothers from their babies. It tells us what to read. It tells us what to study in school. It is destroying our leisure time and robbing us of vacations. It creates high levels of stress in our lives. What is it? It's a four-letter word that has become the center of most people's lives today. It's W-O-R-K, work. Most of us are working more and enjoying it less. And I don't just mean working on a job. There's also work to ensure we remain employable, such as reading in your field and taking seminars or classes at a local university at night. There is caregiving work for people with disabilities or elderly adults. Retirement often means switching from a paid job to days filled with unpaid chores. There is housework and yard work. We're surrounded by work on all sides. Many work two or three jobs to make ends meet. Many people don't have time to leave their desks at lunch, and sometimes even for dinner. They eat at their desk while continuing to work. I can't tell you how many times I've had to do that. Now, go to a restaurant and see how many people are talking on their cell phones or texting. It's not uncommon to see two people at a table, each talking to someone on their cell phones. And in an airport, it seems like people are constantly on cell phones, even in the bathroom. I remember hearing a man in a stall conducting business as he was making business. Additionally, paid vacation time has declined, as has the average time workers are off sick. We're not healthier. We just work more while we're ill. TV ads constantly sell medicines that mask the symptoms of illness so you can keep working. We find ourselves getting fewer fulfillments from our work. Yet in interviews about work-life trade-offs, workers say it's easier to be a success on the job than in their private lives. In a world of divorce, teenage violence, drugs, and double careers, people find their private lives even more complex and baffling than their work lives. While we are told to prioritize money over loyalty and job fulfillment, an increasing number of people are turning to their jobs to provide the security and fulfillment they're not finding in their personal lives. Their personal lives lack shalom. When workers come home, they often bring their work with them. In a way, this allows them to stay in the comfort zone of work when entering the more challenging home environment. There's pressure to read at home, to stay current with trends in their field. Rather than relaxing at home, many work on their computers, checking emails, surfing the internet for job-related information, and reviewing their voicemail. While driving down the interstate, they are talking on their cell phones. On an airplane, they log in and begin working using the plane's Wi-Fi. We're living in a totally wired society. And ironically, the baby boomer generation, which came of age shouting its contempt at the older generation, has done more than any other generation to erase the line between work and private life. The old distinction between work and leisure has fallen apart. A growing number of students work 40-hour-a-week jobs and take a full load of classes, and I have no idea when they sleep. Their learning has definitely suffered. So isn't it a paradox that the same technology that was supposed to make us all wealthy and give us a life of ease has actually contributed to the work-life squeeze? Indeed, new jobs have been created by new technology. However, the pressure to adapt to these rapid technological changes is greater than ever and continues to increase. The new technology not only forces us to put in longer hours out of fear of losing our jobs, but also pushes us to the limit of our learning. We're constantly expected to learn new ways of working, new software releases, and to be totally mobile. We even have mobile offices in our car. The work environment has become increasingly demanding of our time and attention, and the world in general is becoming more complex and dangerous. Economic uncertainty is a reality. We live in the most prosperous time in all of history, and yet uncertainty surrounds us at every turn. We live in a world that prioritizes things over people, rather than valuing people and using things in a balanced way. It is a world devoid of agape love. It is a world devoid of true joy. It is a world devoid of God's shalom. Now, shalom begins with knowing God. But it is more than a left brain knowing. Our left brain thinks in terms of doctrine. Too many people who call themselves Christians lack right brain love, joy, and relational attachment. Doctrine is not all there is to being a Christian. Years ago, I was sitting in a congregation in another location, and a minister who unfortunately is no longer with us stood up and said, "Doctrine is everything." You see, to develop holy, righteous character and to become a true disciple of Jesus Christ, you must first and foremost love God the Father and Jesus Christ. Turn over to John 14 and we'll read verse 15. John 14 and verse 15. Here John writes, "If you love me, keep my commandments." Now let's look at that. Notice what comes first. Love. Not commandment keeping. Love. Jesus taught that love toward God and love toward our fellow man are the two most important commandments. Therefore, to be a true Christian, these two commandments must come first. There is nothing more important in a Christian's life than developing a loving relationship with God and with our brothers and sisters. Nothing. Listening to a sermon or a Bible study is good, but that is primarily a left brain activity. Left brain thinking does not build character. Too many churches are left-brained communities. They focus mainly on doctrine. They neglect the importance of creating a loving community. It becomes more important to be right than loving. The proliferation of church splits is often due to an over-reliance on espousing correct beliefs and neglecting character development, relational skills, and maturity. When a doctrinal difference arises, people walk out and sever relationships, never looking back. And such behavior occurs when love and relational joy are not the primary factors that hold the church together. Turn over to John 13 and we'll read verse 35. John 13 and verse 35. These are all very familiar scriptures. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. It didn't say if you don't eat pork. It doesn't say, you know, that you tithe. No, it says if you love one another. Love is first. It's the first of the commandments. All else falls into a lower level to the love. To live shalom, we must intentionally invite God's presence into every sphere of our life. People who genuinely love one another are long-suffering and kind. They are patient with one another. They seek first to understand rather than to be understood. Turn over to Romans 13 and verse 8. Romans 13 and verse 8. Another very familiar scripture, but let's see what it's saying there. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. The church did not start out being left-brained. In the book of Acts, we find a vibrant, whole-brained community. Today, most professing Christians are left-brain dominant, just as the society around us is. The primary focus is on thoughts and words and strategies, arguments. Relational skills and maturity are largely neglected. In such an environment, narcissism thrives, especially in positions of leadership. Authentic servant leadership, which is grounded in love, is lacking. True Christian servant leaders create a loving culture of shalom. They lead by example. They are dedicated to creating more servants. Turn over to number 6 and we'll read verses 22 through 26. Number 6, verses 22 through 26. Now think about this. Here, God is speaking directly to Moses. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. The word translated peace is the Hebrew word shalom. The Hebrew word shalom is often translated as peace, but its meaning extends far beyond the absence of conflict. It embodies a sense of completeness, wholeness, fulfillment, harmony, and well-being. In the biblical context, shalom signifies a harmonious relationship with God, oneself, and others. This concept is introduced in the very first chapter of Genesis, where God creates the world and declares it good. In Genesis 1, we see the unfolding of creation culminating in humanity being made in the image of God. And this divine image is a reflection of shalom, as humans were designed to live in a harmonious relationship with God and one another. The Garden of Eden represents the epitome of shalom, where Adam and Eve experienced unbroken fellowship with their Creator. Shalom begins with having a relationship with God. The creation narrative sets the stage for understanding shalom as an ideal state of existence in which everything functions in perfect harmony. Adam and Eve experienced this shalom before they sinned. One of the first things to understand about shalom is that Satan hates it. Satan inspires war, the opposite of peace, harmony, and wholeness. He stirs up division and hatred. And he was a murderer from the beginning. And Satan is also the god of this present age. All the problems of our materialistic world work that I described at the very beginning of this split sermon are a picture of a world under Satan devoid of shalom. Now, I'm sure everyone here has heard about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. However, many have not heard that Charlie Kirk came to understand the relevance of the seventh-day Shabbat and shalom. Right before his death, he completed his last book, Stop in the Name of God, Why Honoring the Sabbath Will Transform Your Life. There's a picture of the cover. It's scheduled to be released in 3 days on December the 9th. His wife will be featured on Fox, both in the morning and also on the 5, talking about his new book. Charlie discovered that observing the Sabbath isn't a rejection of modern life, but listen to this, a rebellion against the busyness and the constant pull of technology that I described at the beginning of this message. There are still many unanswered questions regarding Charlie's assassination. However, I'm totally convinced that, above the politics, the real enemy that took out Charlie was a wicked spirit. I personally believe that he was a martyr. I find that interesting that both our messages bring up the same word, martyr. Charlie was very influential, you see, with the youth. Just think how many young people would have heard him talk about the Sabbath and his date and his book. The evil spirits hate the Sabbath and shalom. You see, we are ultimately dealing with spiritual wickedness. Turn over to Ephesians 6 and we'll read verse 12. Again, a very familiar scripture. Ephesians 6 and verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Charlie was killed on September the 10th, 2025. And by the way, he had 20 million people watching his funeral. That came within 1 million of Ronald Reagan. That's how many people were watching his funeral. On October the 2nd, Wendy Yurgo Kinney, I spell that Wendy Yurgo-Kinney, wrote an article titled The Gift of Sabbath, What Charlie Kirk Taught Us About Rest. And here's what that article says. I have the article right here. When we think about our dear friend Charlie Kirk, our minds go not only to the massive crowds he inspired, but also to the quiet, sacred moments that revealed his heart for the Lord. One of those moments came at a turning point event when a mutual friend invited me to a private Shabbat dinner with Charlie. I love Shabbat, and until that evening, I hadn't fully understood how deeply it belonged not just to the Jewish people, but also to us as Christians. I visited rabbi from Israel. A visiting rabbi from Israel spoke powerfully, calling Shabbat the heartbeat of the Ten Commandments. That phrase pierced my heart. Think about it. Of all the commandments, honor your father and mother, do not steal, do not kill, do not bear false witness. It is Shabbat that God anchors in the middle. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and rested the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Exodus 20 verses 8 through 11. The rabbi explained that Shabbat is the commandment that teaches us how to live in step with God. It anchors our vertical relationship with Him from which all other commandments flow. Without worship, rest, and remembrance of God, our obedience to the other commandments becomes empty striving. With Shabbat at the center, we live in right relationship with our Creator, and all the other commands, how we treat our parents, our neighbors, and our community gain their true meaning. Charlie embraced this truth. That night, he spoke about how Shabbat had become part of his own life. Charlie didn't just talk about Shabbat, he lived it. He told us that from Friday evening until Saturday evening, he shut off his phone completely. In a world that never stops buzzing, Charlie made space for God and for family. That simple act, choosing silence over noise, presence over distraction, spoke louder than any sermon. It reminded us that honoring Shabbat isn't about restriction, it's about freedom. Freedom from the constant demands of the world, freedom to hear God's voice, freedom to rest in His presence. He described the beauty of setting aside time each week to rest, worship, and draw close to God. He shared with joy that he was even working on a book about this very topic because he wanted Christians to rediscover Shabbat, not as legalism, but as a gift. That evening left an imprint on my life. Since then, Shabbat has become a sacred rhythm for me too. Each week, I set aside time to worship, to reflect, and to rest in the Lord. It has become a reset of my soul, a reminder that I am not defined by my work or my worries, but by God's love. Shabbat is not just about stopping. It's about remembering. It's God's invitation to put aside striving and to rest in his provision. In a world where we are constantly hurried and distracted, Shabbat calls us back to what matters: worship, family, faith, and truth. Almost sounds like the sermonette. The other split sermon. Yes. For Christians, this can be lived out in simple but powerful ways. Family worship and prayer, gathering together around scripture, prayer, or song. Unplugging from work, setting aside emails, phones, and daily grind to truly rest. Shared meals, inviting friends or family to linger at the table in gratitude and fellowship. Personal reflection, journaling, reading, or simply being still before the Lord. These rhythms are not burdens, but blessings. Reminders that our identity is rooted in God, not in performance. Even in his short 31 years, Charlie lived with a fullness and boldness that continues to inspire us. He was courageous in the public square, but he also lived out his faith in the private rhythms of his home and walk with God. His life reminds us that the Christian call is not only to speak truth, also to live it with joy and rest. If we want to honor Charlie's legacy, let us take seriously the gift he cherished, Shabbat. Let us set aside time each week to worship, to pray, to gather with family, and to remember the Lord our God. In doing so, we will find strength not just to endure the battles of our day, but to live boldly and faithfully as Charlie did. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Psalm 34:18. May he comfort Erica, their precious children, Charlie's family, and the entire Turning Point family. And may he awaken in us the boldness to live faithfully, rooted in truth, strengthened by rest, and sustained by his presence. Charlie showed us that one life fully surrendered to God can change history. We may carry that torch forward with Shabbat as our heartbeat. End of the article. Charlie was a devoted family man. He brought Shabbat Shalom into his home. Charlie advocated getting married, having children, raising them according to biblical principles. Satan hates the family and the marriage between a husband and a wife. Charlie represented the opposite of what Satan promotes, which is transgenderism, divorce, abortion, homosexual marriage, lawlessness, and economic slavery through socialism and communism. If it destroys the family, physically, spiritually, emotionally, or economically, Satan is all for it. Ultimately, universal shalom will be restored when God dwells with his family once again. The biblical narrative of shalom culminates in the book of Revelation, where we see a vision of the new heaven and the new earth. Revelation 21 describes a future where God dwells among his people, wiping away every tear and eliminating death, mourning, and pain. This ultimate restoration signifies the fulfillment of shalom, where God's original design is fully realized. The prophetic vision of shalom extends beyond individual peace to encompass the entire cosmos, reflecting God's desire for wholeness and harmony in all of creation. Even the wild animals will be part of shalom. Turn over to Revelation 21 and we'll read verses 1 through 4. Again, a very familiar scripture. Revelation 21, verses 1 through 4. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, come down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." The sin of Adam and Eve in Genesis 3 disrupted shalom. It disrupted shalom, leading to a fractured relationship with God and a loss of shalom. The family of Adam and Eve no longer experienced shalom, and before very long, the very first murder was committed. And we just read in Revelation 21, universal shalom, first experienced in the Garden of Eden, will ultimately be restored. God dwells in shalom. Think about that. God is also perfect love. Shalom was always part of God's original design for humanity, and it will be restored through the saving work of the second Adam, Jesus Christ. Even the need for Christ's sacrifice was part of the plan to restore shalom from the foundation of the world. That was in Revelation 13 and verse 8. Throughout the Old Testament, the theme of shalom recurs in various contexts. The Israelites were often reminded of their covenant relationship with God, which is rooted in the concept of shalom. The Sabbath was created as a gift for man when God rested on the seventh day of creation. Think about this. The number seven symbolizes completeness, perfection, and wholeness, which is also the meaning of shalom. The Sabbath is a sign between man and God, picturing the ultimate fulfillment of shalom. Turn over to Hebrews 4 and we'll read verses 8 through 10. Hebrews 4, verses 8 through 10. "For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his." Shabbat shalom does not depend on your circumstances, but rather on your relationship with God and others. Relational conflict can hinder our experience of shalom. As much as is within you, be a peacemaker. In a world obsessed with busyness, work, and achievement, create space for rest and reflection on the Sabbath. Prophets like Isaiah speak of a future where shalom will be restored, envisioning a time when swords will be turned into plowshares and nations will live in harmony and peace. This prophetic vision emphasizes that shalom is not merely a personal experience, but a communal reality that God desires for all of creation. The longing for shalom becomes a central theme in Israel's narrative. And in the New Testament, the concept of shalom takes on new dimensions through the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and his ministry embodies the fulfillment of shalom. Jesus gives us a peace that the world cannot provide. He reconciles us to God through his sacrificial death and resurrection, restoring the broken relationship caused by sin. In his teaching, Jesus emphasized love, forgiveness, and reconciliation, inviting his followers to live out shalom in their relationship with others. This radical call to peace challenges societal norms and invites a transformative way of life. The early church embraced the concept of shalom as it sought to live in unity with one another. Acts 2 describes the believers sharing their possessions, breaking bread together, and living in unity. This communal expression of shalom reflects the heart of the gospel, where individuals are called to love and serve one another. The Apostle Paul frequently encouraged the church to pursue peace and unity, reminding them that shalom is a fruit of the Spirit. The church is to be a living testament to the transformative power of shalom in a fractured world. Understanding shalom invites us to reflect on our own lives and relationships. It challenges us to seek peace and wholeness in both our personal lives and our communities. The journey towards shalom requires intentionality as we navigate conflicts and strive for reconciliation. It calls us to be peacemakers, embodying the principles of love and forgiveness that Jesus exemplified. Living out shalom is not a one-time event, but a continuous lifestyle. It is a way of life. It involves daily choices that reflect our commitment to peace and wholeness. Shalom can manifest in simple acts of kindness, such as listening to others and seeking understanding in disagreements. Shalom challenges us to be proactive in creating environments where everyone feels valued and respected. The world is filled with troubles and challenges, but God's shalom is unshakable. When we anchor ourselves in God's sovereignty, trust his promises, and become agents of peace, we experience and share the fullness of shalom. Turn to Colossians 3 and we'll read verse 15. Colossians 3 and verse 15. And let the peace, that is, the shalom of God, rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. Shabbat shalom.